Hi guys, Jamie here from They Think It's All Sober. Just to let you know, this week's episode contains extreme language and conversation around sexual abuse, suicide, and death. Please only listen if you feel safe.
The bigger picture is the fact that why would I want to use or have a drink? My life's fucking incredible. Mm. My life is incredible. When you could get clean and they say, oh, you're going to get a life beyond your wildest dreams, and you just think, oh, fuck off. Do you get what I mean? I have got everything that I was promised and more. I have freedom. I have self-respect. I can love. I love who I am. Therefore, I can love someone else.
Have you ever been face down in the toilet at 4 a.m, spewing up your guts, thinking to yourself, I can't do this again?
Or maybe you've waited 55 minutes in the rain outside a pub to meet a dealer, just to find out he ain't coming.
Broken bones, empty wallets, and lost friends. With big nights come big regrets.
And hey, we're not here to judge. We've had some absolute howlers on the sesh ourselves, but now we're trying to draw the line. I'm Jamie.
And I'm Tom.
And we're two old friends who, after over 30, that's harrowing, Tom, combined years in the music industry, have decided that change is upon us.
It's been hard, but it's very possible. And that's why we started this podcast, to be your support for a life free from the naughty stuff.
Join us each episode as we interview celebrities, musicians and influencers about cutting down on substances from their lives. Hear about how they did it, their motivations and how they're coping.
We aren't here to preach. No judgment, no rights or wrongs, no censoring. This is just an honest account of people changing their relationship with alcohol.
Welcome to They Think It's All Sober.
They think it's all over.
Good afternoon, my liege.
Good afternoon, sir. How are you?
I'm good. Guess what?
Go on.
Just over a month until our live show.
It fucking is.
1st of May, Leicester Square Theatre.
You've gone straight in today.
Mate, just raw dogging it
no
straight
rest
away.
For the wicked.
No rest for the wicked. Yeah, 1st of May, Leicester Square Theatre. We are taking over. Tickets have been flying out the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, I'm excited. And it was nice to sit down with you for a couple of hours today before I fly to Australia and just like smash out the format, smash out the presentation, make all the cool, sexy, cool, wicked, cool bits happen.
And we're about to go on a filming adventure, but we won't say anything more about that.
Keep that quiet.
Very quiet.
I got a question for you.
Go on.
Because when we came in, producer G asked us to get him a meal deal, which I can see him enjoying right now.
Yeah.
What's your meal deal of choice?
My meal deal of choice? Yeah. What if I had to, you know, £5 go
yeah.
in?
Yeah, yeah.
To be honest, mate, my classic one would have been BLT.
Okay.
And prawn cocktail.
Crisps.
Crisps.
Nice.
Not just like...
where you're fucking
BLT,
shopping.
Prawn and lobster cocktail. And normally a coconut water.
Oh, that is rogue, but I respect it.
It is, but it's slowly morphed. I don't really do the meal deals anymore. Mm. I'm just
too
on
bougie.
The...
Nah,
yeah, mate.
Like a quinoa salad.
Mate, I'll tell you what I am on is the... If I'm in a rush now and I don't meal prep, M&S do a really good range down. We've got one quite near the studio. It's like £5.50, which granted is, you know, maybe...
For dinner or for lunch?
Sometimes both if I'm...
Ah. Double dip.
If I'm stretched, but they do a really
Marks
nice balance.
And Spencer's.
I know.
Oh, you're not going to ask me?
Go on.
Chicken salad.
Okay.
I like those like fiery punch crisps, you know, the ridge cut ones. They're not paprika. They're like, I think they're called like fiery.
Yep.
And a Coke Zero.
Interesting.
One must also say.
Yep.
That if you were to shop at Sainsbury's, Lucky Saint is now available in the meal deal.
Yeah.
So you could crack a zero at lunchtime.
You could. And there becomes the whole realm of when's acceptable to drink a zero.
Well, yeah, exactly. Who was it, Jimmy? Was it Jimmy that was like, sometimes I crack one at 10 a.m. whilst I'm driving?
Yeah.
Legal, maybe frowned upon.
Maybe frowned upon.
Just for anyone listening that might be confused, I am currently coming to you from Australia.
You are.
But I'm not there yet.
You are.
I go on Monday.
Correct.
But we had to get this done.
We did.
In part of our like plan to deliver video content.
Yeah.
I had to do this before I went.
Yeah, we did. And it's, I mean, we're committed to the pod. We always have been. And we always make time to make sure that we get it done.
I could pretend that I'm there now. So ask me some questions.
How are the koalas?
Oh, they're lovely, mate. Full of chlamydia, but they're all right.
How's the weather?
Stunning.
Excellent. How's Melbourne treating you?
Beautifully. I love it. Fitzroy's lovely. Yet. Brunswick's stunning. I would move here in a heartbeat.
Yep, there we go. there's the lie.
Yeah, live from Melbourne. I'm buzzing though. I can't wait to go.
Mate.
But this week's guest felt like, as we were in the studio with them and they were coming in and we're so excited, I kind of wanted to get the energy of like the guest coming in ahead of that.
Yeah.
Which means that we can't be like, you guys are going to love this episode because we've got no idea what's going to happen.
Well, exactly.
But I'm assuming it's going to be top tier.
It will be top tier.
Yeah.
No two ways about it.
Premium.
Premium.
Where are we going after the pod as well?
We are filming, but we're also going to West Ham.
We're
going to
watch West Ham, hopefully. Hopefully by the time this comes out, we're in the Europa League quarterfinals.
Yep.
If we're not, don't like football anyway.
Yeah.
You love golf.
Yeah.
You're that guy.
And you're playing golf from here furthermore.
I'm never, no.
Mate.
You can try and get me into it. Like I'm open to enjoying new sports. I'm just something about it, man.
I will convert you.
Gives me the heebie-jeebies.
I will convert you. Don't you worry about it. So, this week's guest.
This week's fucking guest.
This is a big one.
I couldn't believe how quickly this came together, and I feel so grateful and honoured that this person's willing to sit down with us because they are, regardless of sobriety, I think, an absolute fucking legend.
Mate, I could not agree more. And they are currently 13 minutes away in an Addison Lee.
They are.
We better get prepped and we better do the intro. So,
zing, zing, zing.
Zing, zing, zing. So I'm going to throw it to you if you would like to introduce this week's guest of honour.
We have critically acclaimed worldwide DJ, best-selling author, 17 years sober, and I think going to be one of the most interesting conversations we've ever had. It is none other than DJ Fat Fucking Tony. Woo! Woo! Welcome to They Think It's All Sober, Sir Fat Tony.
Sir Fat Tony?
Yeah, I'm knighting you now.
You're knighting me? I prefer to be Dame Fat Tony.
Okay, we can go with that.
Hi, how are you doing? You good?
Yeah, really well. Good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, apart from having to be in Hackney.
The absolute pilgrimage that you've just had to make.
Coming from civilization to abomination.
Yeah.
I feel like it's tough because we feel the same, but we have to stay like positive about it because we're here, and no offense, G, but it isn't the arse end of nowhere.
Well, you get to Oslo quicker than here.
Oslo's prettier.
It is much prettier.
And also a venue in Hackney, so...
But there we go. Yeah.
There we go, right?
Here we go.
I think most people from Oslo live in Hackney these days.
I think so.
Yeah.
The place to be, so they say.
You know, probably most people from Hackney have been moved to Oslo, you know, with our current state of affairs
and
our government.
Both fucking expensive.
Exactly, so, right?
There you go. So, but how are you? I've seen you.
I'm really well, yeah.
Really busy at the moment.
I've been really busy for years. No, but like, you know, it's a different kind of busy, you know. DJing and what I do for a living is always busy. And then the extraterrestrial stuff that comes from being who I am and what I believe in, it takes you to a different level. Yeah, it's mad. It's good.
Nice.
And I love being busy. I look at it as like I don't get tired. I'm hungry. I'm hungry for more and it's good. It's a good way to be.
Yeah, I love that. I think we always feel the same, isn't it? When people ask you how you are and you say busy, I always think, good. Busy is good. It's not stressful.
Also, it's a bit of an arsehole, isn't it? How are you? You're right. Yeah, I'm busy.
Because
it really fucks me off when people, you message people and go, hi. Oh, sorry, I'm busy. I'll call you later. So, aren't we all busy?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
It's like me now.
You know what I mean? Exactly.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I'm really busy. Yeah, of course you are. Sitting at home watching TV.
Just watching The Gentleman.
Loose women is a busy job.
But that comes from social media. That comes from that whole, oh, yeah, I can tell you where I am, but I'm not really there element. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, just doom scrolling.
Doom scrolling. But, thank you very much for joining us. And as always on They Think It's All Sober, I think we have guests on from all walks of life. And I think your journey is one that's going to be of interest to a lot of people. I'm sure most people will be familiar with you already. But for those that aren't, I think it'd be really great to kind of shed some insight into your journey and all of the wonderful positives that you found since sobriety. But I think, first of all, we like to kind of go back in Jamie's time machine to where it all started.
That's impressive.
Kind of explore young DJ Fat Tony's childhood relationship with alcohol and kind of go from there.
It's weird because I was wondering where that hairstyle had come from. So it's actually a part of a time machine.
I'm so fully
were
in
you,
character.
You were back there earlier today,
I'm
right?
Fully, yeah, I was. Okay, I was going to stay there, but I didn't bring the hot tub for us all. So
we're going back to the 70s.
go on. Before.
Yeah, let's go. Right, time
18th
machine,
century. You ready to step into my time machine?
Yeah, let's go. Okay,
let's go.
And
you're back. So.
So what year are we back to? To my childhood?
Yeah, I think childhood. I mean, what we like to do, I guess, is have your... We like to kind of time frame the relationship that most people have with drink, drugs, everything else. As we kind of refer to it as the good, the bad, and the ugly. Because most people have a timeline where they might have had a relationship with alcohol that was maybe positive, and then life happens.
Yeah, of course.
So it'd be nice to just, I guess, ascertain what your sort of first memories of alcohol were.
So, you know, for me, alcohol was always a no-no because I come from a really alcoholic background.
Right.
My father's an alcoholic, his sister, his brother, his dad, that whole entire side of the family were really, really bad alcoholics. A couple of them died from alcoholism. It was in their blood. My dad had this chemical reaction every time he drank scotch that made him violent. He would drink beer all week or whatever, you know, casually, the odd beer here, the odd beer there. We had a bar in our house, you know, in the cabinet that was full of liquor but was never drank.
Right.
Only at weekends or when he went out, he would drink beer and then it would turn to scotch, and that's when trouble happened. Right. So for me, growing up in that environment where on a Sunday morning my mum would be either on her way to hospital because she's taken an overdose, or at the bottom of the stairs because my dad's hit her, or any of those things that went on that were associated with alcohol, it was always a no-no. But saying that, I was always drawn to it. I found it, you know, I had an alcoholic auntie that used to come to my house that I was obsessed with. We weren't allowed to talk to her because she was an alcoholic. So the thing about alcoholism is, you know, if you've got an alcoholic in the family, the last thing they want is another alcoholic knocking on the door, showing them up, showing them for what it is. You know, it's like homophobia. It's like, oh yeah, he's a poof, get rid of him, just to cover up the fact that, oh God, I don't want anyone knowing I'm a poof.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same with alcoholism. You know, so my dad hated her coming to the house because it drew attention to his drinking. Right. It drew attention.
It's almost like they're just holding the mirror up, right?
Exactly that. Yeah. So she weren't allowed to come to the house, but we lived in this estate in Battersea by Lavender Hill that had these big grass hills by the bus stop. My aunt used to come and she'd drink woodpecker cider, bottles of it, and lay on the grass. And I was obsessed by that energy. I was obsessed by the crazy. I was drawn to the crazy straight away. She would throw the empty bottles at buses and I just loved it. I was like, oh, I just want to be like my auntie. And I used to like say to my mum and dad, can I go and stay with Auntie Jenny? And they'd be like, no. And I'd be like, and I would manipulate it so I could stay with her because I was so obsessed by that energy. So, you know, it was inevitable that the direction I was going in life, because I found that so exciting.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, I mean, were you quite self, I guess, from what you're saying, you were quite aware that alcohol kind of represented trouble from quite a young age?
Well, yeah, totally, because it changed who my dad was. It changed the dynamics in our house. It made that whenever alcohol was brought into any equation, it never ended well, ever. It was never like, it was like, okay, we're going to have one drink and we're all going to bed. No. We would go on holiday to the caravan and my grandparents would be there and they'd all go to the clubhouse. And by 2 a.m., my grandparents would be packing their bags and leaving. You know, it always escalated so quickly to drama and to trouble. And, you know, being the most alert member of the family, because I always knew what my sexuality was, I was always alert to these things and I was always sensitive, more sensitive to that dynamic change, because I had to be. I had to be on my own toes. I had to be alert. I had other stuff going on in my life at that point in time when I was a kid that I had to deal with on top of that stuff. So when you highlight one area, I was always really, really sensitive to the whole alcohol change thing.
That's really interesting. And when you said you were drawn to your aunt, was it like the free-spirited nature of it, or was it the chaos? Like, do you know what it both. Was that drew you in?
It was both. It was literally because she didn't give a fuck. And, you know, someone that would walk up the road pretending to be a penguin whilst drinking cider was just like, oh, fucking hell, she's incredible. Do you know what I mean? Because she was everything that my mum and dad weren't.
Right.
And, you know, she was everything that anyone else on my estate wasn't either. And she did it with such class and such style, being that, but she was so much fun. And yeah. I was drawn to that element of fun. And what it did do was showed me that oh my God. Okay, so there is a fun side to alcohol, to someone drinking cider.
Yeah.
Do you hear what I mean?
Yeah.
Not just destruction and mayhem.
No.
You know, there was...
And my dad didn't like that. My dad didn't like the fact that people liked her because she was a drunk. Little did I know at the time, she just lost her husband, had been stabbed to death in Pimlico where she lived. And so she turned to alcohol. And but to me, I didn't know that because that was kind of kept away from us kids. But so I was just drawn to that insanity. But the insanity was there for a reason.
Mm.
It was her way of coping.
Yeah, of course.
Like all of us, you know, there's certain things happen in our lives that we, the first thing most people say, oh, I need a drink. You don't need a drink. You know, you need someone to sit and listen to you. But, you know, the thing about it is we always go to that point. And I didn't know that about her. So it wasn't until much later on in life that I realised when I found out the true ins and outs of what Jenny was about. You know, she's still alive now. She's one of the only ones that's still alive out of the family, out of that side of the family.
Well, you know,
she stopped drinking, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, fair play to her. I mean, it sounds like we cover this a lot, but there's always something else underlying, isn't there, that beneath addiction?
Yeah, always. I mean, you know, the thing about it is if you come from a family that has addiction and alcoholics, it's in our wiring, it's in our DNA, it's definitely a generic thing. You know, the whole addict thing is definitely handed down. It's in our wiring. So, you know, it doesn't always mean you're going to end up on a fucking park bench. What it means is that you need to watch those behaviours. We have obsessive personality disorder. We obsess around things more than most people. And, you know, when we get into recovery and further down the line and we realise what we got going on wrong with us and we channel it, it can become a superpower. But back then it's mass destruction.
Of course.
And it's, you know, you watch it pan out, you know, through other people. And I thought to myself, I'm never going to be like them. I'm not going to do that. That's not who I want to be. I'm not going to drink. And don't get me wrong, of course, we used to steal bottles of vodka out of the cupboard to be on the estate and hang out with our mates or whatever, and we'd always drink. But every time I drank when I was a child, I was always blackout. Right. I would always be the one that was still out. You know, when I left school at 14, I got thrown out of school at 14 and I went to work in the King's Road. We all went from work afterwards to the pub, the Chelsea Potter on the King's Road, and we would drink pints of snake bite. I was always the last one in there. I never went home early. I was never the one that said, oh, I'm not drinking tonight. Because as soon as I, you know, like the old saying, one is too many, a thousand is never enough. As soon as I started drinking, I had this thing in me that just couldn't get enough.
Yeah.
Because it was that whole, you know, without sounding cliched, it changed the way I felt, and it gave me the confidence I needed to be the funniest one in the room. So yeah. I thought I was the funniest one. Like all of us think we're the funniest one, we've had a drink in us. And we're not funny at all. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah.
The talent doesn't come from alcohol.
No.
No, of course.
I was going to ask about that because you've kind of got there already. Like, I was going to ask what the function of alcohol was to you at that period.
Mm.
And, you know, I think we're, you know, both children of addicts as well. And you never think you're going to get into the position that you maybe witnessed growing up.
No.
So what was the function? Because even if you were going out early and getting blackout drunk, etc., did you realise maybe that wasn't healthy? Did you see any similarities? What was the function for you at that point?
From the age of 10 to 14, I worked for a guy that abused me and I was sexually abused. And it's in my book. And it's like literally what that did was suddenly I put on loads of weight. I became really fat, hence the name Fat Tony. And it became a castle. And then, of course, what happens is the older you get, the more in touch with who you are and what you look like. And then people are calling you the name Fat Tony. Suddenly you think, oh, I don't want to be Fat Tony. I want to change. So what happens is those walls come down and suddenly what you're left with is vulnerable little Tony in the corner. So what we find is we pick up other shields and we pick up other tools, and drinking became a tool. It became another way so that I could get through the day. I could get, you know, I wasn't drinking all day. I would drink after work and the next day I would always have a hangover and go to work. And, you know, it became another crutch.
Yeah.
And it was never a problem. Alcohol wasn't a problem. I was having the time of my life, like all of us think we're having. And, you know, alcohol for me never was a problem until I stopped. That's when it became a problem. Because that's when I realized, fuck, I always thought I had a class A problem. I was always proud of the fact that I was a cokehead or whatever other head I became. I was always proud of that because that's what we do. We make it, we justify it, and we turn it into a badge of honor. Wherever, you know, however bad it gets, it's always a badge of honor still.
Sure.
Yeah, do you know, because I used to say to people, you know, when I had, like, right at the end, when I had no teeth and I weighed 7 stone, I used to say to people, do you know how much money it costs to look like this? Do you know, that was my justification.
Yeah.
You know, I was, like, fucking homeless, but I still was trying to wear it as a badge of honour because I made a career out of being a car crash towards the end, because we justify, as addicts, we're really good at building foundations for our addiction. We're really good at building fake walls and fake houses, you know, that get blown over really easy, but they look fucking great.
Yeah.
Do you get what I mean? They don't withstand the cold temperatures or the rain, but they look all right for an hour.
Yeah.
You know, that we're all right with that hour.
Yeah.
Because that hour will carry us out, and we can dine out on that for the next 6 months.
Yeah.
But you know, that's what we do as addicts. And for me at a really young age, it was never a problem. Because there was no other problems. I was drinking on a problem.
Yeah,
I was covering up that fact of what had happened, trying to block that out. But that's not me justifying it, because it was a natural progression.
Of course.
There was never a moment I thought I need to drink to cover this up, or need to drink just to get through the day. I was having fun.
Yeah, and it must have been, it's kind of a hindsight thing now when you look back and, you know, you can see that. But so I guess let's timeline it. So, you know, obviously it sounds like you went for a very traumatic period between that 10 and 14, left school, you're working, drinking a lot, having the time of your life. Now, when did the, I guess, drugs kind of enter the equation?
They didn't come until like about a month later. No, they didn't come until like, so I was always going out clubbing from the age of 14, 15. So literally that progression happened. You know, I was going out clubbing and the nights would get longer and the days, the amount of time I was going out more and more and more, that became a new addiction. That, you know, the minute I went into a nightclub was the minute that my life began, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
I suddenly thought, I never ever want to leave.
Do you remember that first moment?
Yeah, I went to the Embassy Club, and it was the first club I'd ever been in. And I just thought, I never ever want to leave here. And I kind of haven't. Do you know what I mean?
So you came to fucking Hackney.
Yeah, well, you know, but it's always been there. But, you know, that whole desire to want to live in a different world. You know, even as a kid at school, when I was at school, I used to tell people my dad did a different job to the job that he did. And I got away with it. People believed it. And they wanted to be my friend because my dad drove racing cars for a living and blah, blah, blah. He was a plumber. But, you know, him being a plumber, that kind of put a roof over our head, and we had a lovely house in Battersea, and everything that we had came from my dad being a plumber, was not enough for me.
Right.
I always wanted people to think that he was more than. I always, you know, thought that, you know, people would like you for what you had and not for who you were. And that kind of served me very well for a very long time. So what happens is when you get away with one thing there, you get away with a lot of other things, and it becomes a defense of character. It becomes a defect. It becomes who you are. So reality's not good enough. Reality's not, you know, however, by the time I was 16, I had 17, my DJing career took off, you know, and then I was drinking more and more. I was in more and more clubs. And it wasn't until one Saturday night, my friend said to me, you need to stop drinking or you need to start taking cocaine to counteract the drink. And I was like, no, I don't like it. And I'd done it before, a very, very well documented time that I went to someone's house after the Club Heaven. And I said it in a conversation when I did this Mixmag film about Freddie Mercury. And it suddenly became a tagline for my life, because suddenly it was like, Freddie Mercury gave me my first line of cocaine. And it was said in a conversation. Suddenly it became a boast, and it was never a boast.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there was another one that said, you know, I spent over £1 million on drugs. Which was, it was true, but it was not a boast. Yeah. But when you take it out of the context of that conversation, yeah, it suddenly becomes, oh, you know, I like Ferraris. It's, none of it's a boast. None of it was, it's not a badge of honour. It's never like, oh my God, look at me, I'm the biggest caner. Because it wasn't about that. So, you know, going back to it, you know, when the cocaine slowly kicked in. I was like, oh, I'll try it. I'll do a bump just to stop me from going into that next level of alcohol. And suddenly I realised I could stay out longer and I could stay sober longer by levelling out that with that.
And you didn't have to leave the club.
No, I didn't. And that was it. That became the way of life. And very quickly, for something I didn't like, I did because it was a part of my job. Mm-hmm. that was my justification at the time. I just thought, oh, well, you need to do this because this is what you need to do, you know. You need to be on the ball.
Yeah. It's, you know, and I guess at the time you're thinking, well, this is what happens. It's part of the job, mm. you know. Helps me stay on it and go longer.
But don't get me wrong, you know, the amount of fun times that went with those times were just incredible. I think if it had gone sour straight away, 28 years would not have gone by the way they did. I think if it had gone, if I'd hit rock bottom the week after I did the first gram,
yeah,
life would be very different. It manifested into what it manifested in, and there was never a stop button.
Yeah, I think that's the thing with cocaine. I certainly found it was like 15 years, bang, bang, bang. All of a sudden I'm like, whoa, I hit my mid-30s and was like, this is really not okay. And yeah. It takes that time. It's a slow builder, isn't it?
Well, you know, you get yourself into this position where you think that you're having fun. And the sad thing about it is we suddenly stop going to parties and we think we are the party. And that's when everything changes, the moment that we think we're the party. Because we think everything's about us and it's... We go into that fourth dimension of life. Do you get what I mean? Where it's insane. And, you know, I got to stages where I didn't give a flying fuck about anything because my career had really taken off and I was earning so much money at such a young age. But that was never enough because my friends were always earning more. When you grow up in a world where most of your friends go on to be pop stars and the biggest pop stars on the planet at that point in time or the biggest this or the biggest that or fashion models or whatever they go into. Because I came from a really, really creative era of the 80s where everybody had to have a platform to be seen or to be heard. You didn't have it in your hand. You couldn't pretend you were someone you're not, you know, on Instagram or on TikTok or any of those things. You had to do something and be fucking good at it to be noticed.
Of course.
And so most of those creatives went on to be the biggest people on the planet. And I was a DJ. I never ever classed myself as one of those people, even though I'd be flying to New York on Concorde or whatever. It was always someone else is doing in my eyes. I always suffered from imposter syndrome. Mm. So I never felt that I was worthy of what I was doing because it was never a chosen career.
Yeah.
DJing was something I fell into. So it was never like, I'm a typical addict. I didn't have goals. Mm. My goal was getting an 8 for Coke on Tick. That was my goal, a weekly goal of, you know, getting the dealer to believe in every bit of shit that I had to say and get what I wanted out of them. That was the only goals I had. I didn't have goals where I thought, right, in 5 years' time, I want this and I want this and I want that. No, that wasn't it. That was never the game plan because there was no game plan.
So you didn't, like, in your head, it wasn't like, I want to go and have a residency at Glitterbox. No. I want to do this. It was like, let's...
No, it wasn't because it was... Yet again, a means and ways to stay out and be at the party. And suddenly, you know, I started this, by chance I became a DJ because I was working in a venue and the guy that ran it, it wasn't even a small venue, it was the Lyceum in the Strand. Right. I was on the door and every week this other DJ called Ian Dewhurst, who was at the top of his game at that point in time, he did DMC and he was like fucking, every week... The guy who owned the club, one of the guys, Steve Stranger and Russ Egan, would say to me, how was tonight? I was like, everyone was leaving early, moaning about the music. They weren't. They weren't at all. I just would say it because it was something to say.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, typical addict bullshit, just coming out of it for the sake of just trying to belittle him and big up myself because I was so insecure, you know, about everything. And every week I would say it, and he was like, you know what, if you think you can do better, you do it. And then the next week I turn up with 4 records. And that suddenly, 2 weeks after that, I had a residency at the WAG. And then from there, I started running the WAG on Saturdays. And then it was like, which was the biggest club in London at that point in time. And then it just all just completely exploded from there. Then I was in New York, and it was all from 4 records. and a lot of mouth. So it was never like, okay, this is going to be my chosen career. This is something I was doing at that point in time.
Yeah.
But that point in time went on till today. Wow. But do you get what I mean? So yeah, it was never that. A chosen thing. And it was never about, because, you know, what came with Fat Tony was Boy George, Kate Moss, all of those people that at that moment that people wanted there. And suddenly, you know, I was doing everybody's parties. I was flying, doing Andy Warhol, I was doing everybody and working with everybody because of my mouth. It was, you know, it was all about rah, 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 rah. And it was like, oh my God, suddenly this new force to be reckoned with had appeared. I was like Taz of Tasmania. It was like fucking go in, smashing every bit of crockery in the place and then leave. And you suddenly get this notoriety about you. And people want you there. They kind of want that chaos. Because that chaos I'd seen in my auntie as a kid with the cider bowls manifested into my own form of chaos that I could get money for.
And if people wanted, I guess, a party of all parties, they'd call you up.
Of course. And that was it. I was flying around the world and suddenly my career went like that. And what went with that when your career goes like that is money.
More drugs, more
as
drink.
A kid... I went through as a kid at 10 with money. I had this real thing with money where I found money dirty and I didn't deserve it because I was being paid by the guy that I was abusing me. I was working for him as his assistant. So money was always changing hands. So it always made me feel dirty. So any bit of money I got, I had to get rid of.
Right. So spend.
Spend everything, literally. When it got really bad, you know, further down the line, the only time I was truly at peace and was happy was I couldn't afford a packet of cigarettes because I knew I couldn't go anywhere. I knew that was it. It's time to call it a night. Yeah. It's time to go to sleep after a week.
Face it.
Yeah. And you know, so money was always a problem because I had to get rid of it. So the best way of getting rid of money is either spending it on loads of clothes or literally just spending it on drugs.
Yeah.
But of course, when you're in that position, you get so many things free anyway. Do you know what I mean? So you have to work double. You have to work double hard. But you don't spend it on paying rent or mortgages. No, God forbid you do that. That's just normal. You're not going to do that. You're going to spend it on absolute shit.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was earning so much money back then. So much money.
When did it stop becoming fun?
It's a good question because, you know, I could probably sit here and give you a number of different eras of when it stopped becoming fun. It stopped becoming fun probably the first day that I bought a gram because suddenly that changed everything. And then what happened was the fun times were always on day three or day four of like at my house where like we were all completely like annihilated or whatever. I was always having fun, but it was never real fun in the sense of like, oh my God, like going on holiday and diving off a boat or any of that stuff. It was
chaotic fun.
Yeah, it was always chaos. And the next day we'd be laughing like, oh my God, can you believe we said that or did that? And it was always at someone else's expense the majority of the time because, you know, you've chipped away so much at your own self-respect and self-esteem and, you know, you have no respect. You don't love yourself, you hate yourself. So you're not going to love anyone else. You're just going to go through the world one by one and hate them. And, you know, because you hate yourself. And the fun really, I think the last 10 years, sounds mad, doesn't it? The last 10 years weren't life, it was survival.
Right.
Because it went on for 28 years and it progressively got worse around 95 when my partner died of AIDS. You know, 95... onwards really was that dip. I'd just had the record deal. I'd gotten my new house, bought the house, the money from the record deal, like, you know, literally living up here in Bloomsbury, like everything was just like on track. And then Tom passed away. The drug addiction had already gone up. It had gone way past using. It was now a daily thing. Then suddenly it got to the point where everyone had enough of Tony, the management. I lost the house. And that's kind of when it kind of started to spiral. 95. I didn't stop using until 2007.
Right.
So, you know, those years were like, kind of like, were the acceptance years in the sense of not me being accepted for what a mess I was, but accepting handouts from friends, accepting the kindness of people that I'd helped in the past or people that were kind of still in the glory years. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah.
And I kind of like, you know, moved from house to house and it got better for a little while, then it get worse again. And, you know, then the drugs changed, you know. Start doing other types of drugs because the drugs that I were on at that point in time weren't hitting the mark. Mm. So then it escalated to at 6 o'clock in the morning, can't get what we want, so let's do crack.
Right.
And then suddenly crack become flavour of the month or year. And then it suddenly would go from there to the next thing and then it would go, I'm not doing that anymore. And it would be like that. And then, of course, what comes into play is, you know, it's not only about class A's, it's about prescription drugs. It's about the downers with the uppers and the roller coasting. You know, I suddenly discovered temazepam, diazepam, Rohypnol that went with the cocaine, that levelled out the cocaine, that levelled out the alcohol.
Right, so it's just tear, like, tear, tear.
Yeah,
tear.
There, it's like that nursery rhyme. There's an old lady who lives, you know, she swallowed a fly to catch the spider to catch.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
yeah.
what it was like. It was really was. I would do this to counteract that to counteract that. And that was it. That was the roller coaster.
It's interesting at that point as well because you're then like medicating to try and get to a point of normality when you probably don't know what that is. And you're like taking this to take that today, that to feel. And you're like, what am I trying to feel at this point?
You know, the thing about it was, I get towards the end, I got to the point where I no longer wanted to live, but I would still go to bed and sleep in the recovery position.
Wow.
Always sleep in the recovery position.
So part
because
of you
I was
did.
Scared that I would choke on my own vomit and sleep. There was a part of me that wanted to die, but there was a part of me that still wanted to live. And it kind of was always like that. Do you get what I mean? It was like, there'd be like day four or day five or whatever mess I was in. And I just think, I can't do this anymore. And I'd be like, I know, let me drink a glass of water. Because I hadn't drank water in like God knows how. I wouldn't drink water. My theory was that Jack Daniels was made with distilled spring water. That's enough water for me. Yeah. And I would pinch my skin, it would stick together and stand up. And I was so dehydrated. What I put my body through was just insane. And then, of course, what happens is, when the further you go down that road, you know, suddenly the body starts to shut down in different areas, things start to happen. And then you kind of like, it freaks you and you don't understand. You know, for me, as I said earlier in this interview, when my partner died of AIDS back in 95, he was diagnosed in 89. 95, he died. 5 years later, he died. And then I'd been tested and I'd done all same day testing and it never came back positive. It was always negative, but they didn't know what they were testing for then. So in 2001, when I was diagnosed HIV positive, I was rushed into hospital. My mum found me collapsed on the floor in my house. And I was rushed into hospital where I stayed for nearly 3.5 months. And I was put into an induced coma because my brain had swollen so much. And they had to reduce the swelling. They didn't know whether I was going to live. They told my parents, like, you know, to expect the worst because my body was in such a bad state. Now, I put that all down to drinking. At the time, I used to think, I'm blacking out because I've been drinking for 3 days. I was blacking out because my brain was fucked. The virus was in so high in the levels that, I literally, they had to lumbar punch me every day to drain the fluid off my brain. And, you know, they didn't know where I was gonna live or not. So, you know, to deal with, go through the AIDS crisis and go through everything else that was going on for a gay man at that point in time, with a drug addiction, with this, you know, it really was so hard not to become a victim of everything. Because as addicts, as you know, we really love to be a victim. We really love, you don't know how hard it is for me. This is why I do what I do. And I kind of think that really helped manifest the addiction. It helped to ease it along a bit because what it was suddenly was I had a reason to be a mess.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because with my dad, right, I didn't talk to my dad for 30 years, basically. Every time I saw him, I rowed with him. I never, ever engaged with him because he used to beat my mum up when I was a kid. He was an alcoholic. How dare he do that to us? You know, I blamed my dad for everything, right? Because it was really easy to do. And then what happened was this drama happened the first year I was sober in 2008. I had this drama where I was bowed down to my mum. I was a year clean. And the worst situation ever in the world could happen to somebody happened to me, being clean and sober. And the reason I'm still sitting here is because I was sober. If I wasn't, I probably would have ended up killing myself or doing something really stupid. And I fought this court case and won, of course, it was vindicated and all this stuff. But they bowed me down to my mum and dad's house in Dungeness in the middle of the winter, right? And I was like, fuck, what do I do? You know, I'm on a beach in Dungeness, freezing cold, like snowing, and like just thinking, oh my God, I couldn't be in a worse place. Well, I was out of prison, but I was there. Mm. And it was probably the most magical thing that ever happened in my life because I got to know my dad. My dad was 30 years sober.
Wow.
And I never knew.
And you didn't know?
Of course I didn't. I didn't want to know. It didn't serve me to know while I was using. It took me to a year. And I remember going to my dad when I got there and saying, look, I'm really sorry for everything I've done. And I'm really sorry for, like, just ruining yours and mum's lives, blah, blah, blah. And my dad said to me, why don't you fuck off and come back to me when you're 6 months clean? I was like, what? You won't come back to me when you're 6 months clean, we'll have this conversation. 6 years clean, sorry, not 6 months. Come back to me when you're 6 years clean and you know what you're apologising for. And I just thought, you cunt. Literally, I just thought, oh, my God, how can you do that to your son that's just got out of prison?
Yeah, you've straight away the victim, right?
How can you do that to me? Straight back to that point of like, yeah, you did this to me. You used to beat my mama. All of these things. My mum and dad were together for 40 years. 40 years they were married for, you know. But I held on to that 1 year where he was drinking. I held on to it all my life and blamed him for everything because it served me well. It made me the victim. And suddenly I could not be a victim anymore. And I just had to, it was that real turning point in my life where I just thought, I can't do this. I have to stand up for myself. This is the way forward. And I stayed, lived with them for 4 months, 5 months down there. And then I got, obviously, as the whole court case panned out, I was allowed to come back to London because they didn't have evidence. So all these things that I was accused of got dropped and suddenly it all panned out. And then we had the trial. I won the trial, you know, vindicated. They were like, they all apologized. You know, it was a very big thing at the time. And a month after that, my dad died in front of me. Yeah. Like, literally. But you know what? That I had to go through that hell of what was the darkest point of my life to find the brightest point of my life, the fact that I spent that time with my dad.
Yeah.
And, you know, was available to be there for him towards the end. And,
yeah.
And the day that he died in front of me. And that was just such an incredible recovery thing for me. That just made me realise nothing beats recovery. Mm. The fact that I could be present and be of service after all of that time. These things don't happen by chance. It happens for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, what I went through with my trial happened so that I could have that moment with my dad. And in my book, I wrote a whole chapter about it because it was really important, you know, that dynamic between me and my father. Because my father was the same person as me. I used to think my dad was the problem. My mum's the fucking problem. She's a fucking nightmare. She always has been and always will be. But, you know, but she's the best person in the world. Yeah. You know, it's so bizarre how we take on stuff from our youth and we drag it along. Mm. As we're dragging, it's getting more and more cigarette butts and old beer cans and everything else underneath it. And before you know it, you're dragging a tip around with you.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you've got like fucking half of Basingstoke landfill behind you. Do you get what I mean?
Big fucking landfill.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
That's amazing though. So, I mean, that's really touching and beautiful thing because like you say, you almost came face to face with what you thought was a problem. And in the end had this kind of moment of obviously sadness, but I can imagine for you in that moment, sobriety, connection, beauty in a weird way.
Yeah, it really was. You know, it was like, it was meant to be. It was like one of those situations that I didn't think, fuck, how am I going to deal with this? And that didn't come into it. I the first thing I thought was, I can deal with this. I can take charge of this. I can deal with all of this stuff. Because recovery had given me so much back already. And that was only a year in to 2 years, around 18 months of being sober and that just having clarity, but also starting to take down the layers of shame and starting to get rid of, like, you know, it's a real learning curve recovery, because we get clean and we suddenly think we're going to be a counsellor. Yeah. I'm going to change the world. I'm a guru. All of you need to come see me. If there's a drug problem, we go through all of that. We go through all of that. I see it every day because I sponsor people, but I see it every day in people. And I literally, it makes me laugh because they'll say something to me and I'm like, yeah, of course. Yeah, go for it. You know, because 6 months down the line, that's going to change. And that's the process of recovery.
Yeah.
We want to change the world when we get clean. We want everyone else to be clean. We want everyone else to have what we have. But as you go through that and you start to work on yourself, which is a fucking big thing, right? That doesn't happen in 6 months in rehab.
No.
That certainly doesn't happen in as soon as you put down the drink and the drugs. I say all the time, you know, you take the rum out of fruitcake, what you're left with, fruitcake, right? And that fruitcake can go one way or the other, you know. And what you learn really quickly is that you don't need drink or drugs to become a problem, because you're a fucking problem.
Yeah, we're all fucking problems.
Yeah, we are. And that's, once we realise that, you know, it's the same realisation as I said before to you, that you, when you realise you're not the party, that's when change comes. And it's exactly the same thing with recovery.
What was the point for you, or was there a point you were like, I've got to stop? Was
it every forced? Weekend. Was
it? Yeah. So when every did you Tuesday. Decide? When did you decide this is it? Fat Tony is.
Well, no, you know, it was literally just after Christmas. No, it wasn't. It was before Christmas, in November. And I just had my birthday party at the Egg. And then the following week, I'd been missing for a week. And I was living with my boyfriend at that point in time because I'd lost my house again. And I was living at my boyfriend's house and he'd thrown me out. He was like, I don't want you here anymore, you've got to go. So I disappeared for a week. And then that day, I was sitting in a Portaloo across the road waiting for him to leave on the scaffold building site opposite his house, you know, in Rosebery Avenue. And I was waiting for him to leave and he left. And I broke in, smashed the window and went in. Stole his new jeans, his fake London jeans, and I stole his credit card and off I went again. Literally just fucked off again. And then that night, bearing in mind I'd been out since the Tuesday and it was now Friday night. And that night I was in a club in Goods Way in King's Cross called the Cross. And I was DJing there, but I was in the back, I was in the green room. And by this point in time, I'd already discovered a new drug, which completely, within 8 months, 9 months, had annihilated me even more so. You know, I had a thing called meth mouth where I pulled all my teeth out because I had animals living in my mouth, and I literally had one tooth left at the bottom that was loose, and I would like sit playing with it. And I would rock backwards and forwards thinking that would stabilise me and make normal. You know, my mental health was so far gone, but of course I thought I was handling it really well because I sprayed myself orange every day and no one would know I was a crackhead or a meth head, basically. Anyway, that night I was rocking backwards and forwards in the green room. And my friend came in, Mark, and said, James is here. And I was like, what? And he was like, James is here. I was like, he's barred. How can he be here? And he'd been barred from the Cross for about a year because he would come every week and drag me out of the DJ box and like have fights with me. And he would tell everyone, you're going to find him dead on your toilet floor. Is that what you want? And I'd be like, oh, my God, bar him. He's a nightmare. He's drama. But what he was trying to do was save my life.
Yeah.
But of course, that's not what you want to hear when you're using. It suddenly becomes an obstacle, and it's an obstacle to my fun. And so he turned up, and I was sitting there literally rocking back and forwards, and I just thought, I can't deal with this. Even though I burgled his house that day, robbed him, I can't.
Can you just fuck off, mate?
I can't deal with this. How dare he be here? Do you know what I mean? And I literally thought, oh, he's going to ask for his credit card. He's going to rip the jeans off me. And I was just sitting there just thinking, can't deal with this. And he literally came into the green room and I was sitting there thinking, how's he got in here? It was like, literally, it was like he's like suddenly become a Jedi master. It was like
going to Fort Knox.
Okay, opening doors with his hand, you know, literally. And I was like sitting there and I was thinking, can't deal with this. And he literally came over and he put his hand on my shoulder. I remember looking up at him, and this is the bit that always gets me. And what he said to me, instead of like, you know, there was no judgment, no argument, there was no fight, he literally just said, what happened to you? And I was like, well, and he was like, what happened to you, babe? You used to be such an amazing person. What happened? And I just like looked at him and I just like crying. And it was that moment that the pilot light came back on. Because up to that point, I wanted to die. Every day I thought about my own funeral. Every day I thought life can't get any worse than this. It can't get any worse than this. So burgling his house meant nothing. Doing what I did on a daily basis, it was survival, it was awful, and I couldn't stop. There was no part of me that thought, okay, you need to stop doing drugs, because that was my life. But, you know, that was, it, as I used to say, my life is shit, but it's my shit. And there's something really comfortable about it, because there was no other direction. It had gone so far down the road, there was no other way out apart from dying. And that night, that, you know, I said to him, I cried my eyes out, I said, I need to leave. And I left the cross and I went home to his house. And then on the Monday, I went to see my GP, Dr. Paul, who's on Amwell Square across the road. I went to see him and I said, I need help. He said, I've been waiting for you to come here and say that for 5 years. And I was like, why didn't you ever say anything? And he was like, because I can't. Why would I? You have to say it. And he then referred me to a drug drop-in centre, which was really good for about a week. And then it was like, you know, my disease was so much greater than I ever was. I couldn't stop. I would pretend, I would go to meetings. A friend of mine suggested meetings. He said to me, oh, there's these meetings, you know, 12-step fellowship meetings that you could go to. There's really good-looking men, you get to hold their hands. I was like, oh, there's a reason to go. So off I went to these meetings, these mythical meetings, because there was never any good-looking men in there. I'm still yet to find that one meeting. It's like the fucking golden fleece of recovery. And I went to these meetings and tried to get clean, but couldn't. I used to sit there gurning. I'd go home and my boyfriend would be like, you've used today. And I'd be like, no, I haven't. And I, you know, gurning with no teeth is not attractive. And he would make me eat fucking spaghetti carbonara, like with pancetta. Try eating pancetta with no teeth and carbonara. You know how dry it is. As torture.
Yeah.
And but, you know, I'd still do it. I'd be like, yeah, this is delicious. Oh, and it was so strange. But, you know, and then what happened was, I kept going and I kept going. And then one Saturday night, I went to a 12-step meeting in Soho. And this lady was sitting there. She had a fake handbag, fake Gucci handbag, fake everything. And I was just sitting there and I just thought, oh, fuck off. Literally, I'll stay 5 minutes and I'll leave. Because, you know, by this point of time, I was still a bit being made to go by proxy. It was still like, right. You want to stay in this house, you need to do that. And I was like, okay, I'll do that, you know, better than sleeping rough again. Because, you know, I'd slept rough so many times in the past few years over that. And this woman opened her mouth and started telling this story. And it just blew me away because it was my life story. Everything she said came out of her mouth. And I'd already sat there and judged her and thought, I'm not going to want to hear what she's got to say. And everything she said, just, I remember leaving and standing on the fence across the road in Fifth Street, holding the railings, crying, and I just thought, what are you doing with your life, man? It's enough. And that was the turning point. That was that moment. I just thought, I can't do this anymore. Really, that's when it stepped up. I got myself 30 days sober before I went to treatment. I managed to get into treatment. I had to go through the whole process, which took 5 months to get into treatment. And I had to be assessed by lots of different doctors and psychiatrists for my mental health. And I didn't think I had a problem with mental health. I thought it was all right. I thought I was like normal. And I remember going to, with my partner at the time, he came with me to my psychiatry appointment. And the doctor was like, do you ever self-harm? I was like, no, why would I self-harm? Why would I do that? And my partner was like, you pulled all your teeth out. And I was like, and? What are you on about? What does it matter? Jeez. But I didn't actually think that as being self-harm.
Yeah, of course.
I normalised it.
That was like cause and effect, right?
It became the norm, you know? Why wouldn't I pull my teeth out? Doesn't everyone pull their teeth out? You know, literally. And it was that was the level of my insanity. But I normalised that kind of like harm and self hatred that I just normalized it. It became so normal. Wow. Yeah, and that was it. Then that was the turning point. And as I say, I was 30 days when I went to treatment, which kind of really helped, you know, because I thought I'd cracked it.
Yeah.
Don't need to get treatment now, 30 days. But, you know, whether it was a real 30 days or a sort of 30 days is neither here or there.
You did it, right? And for you, I think and that sometimes was it. You have to convince ourselves.
That was it.
That's it, right?
There'd been, I'm sure, that I know there was kind of like a few little bumps in the road where I'd thought, oh, I need a drink, or I'd gone into the pub and got shot, or, you know, but there was no cocaine in that that month, which was the main thing for me.
A big deal.
Or any sleeping pills.
Yeah.
Because they were the other one, you know.
Yeah.
Anything with a pan on it, I was like, fucking, yeah, I'll have them. You know,
I guess let's talk about some of the positives that you found,
please.
Because like it's such an incredible journey, and thank you for sharing so much so openly and honestly, and hopefully you're not bored of telling these stories
many times.
But really appreciate it. What was the point in that sobriety journey? Because 17 years is a fucking long time, an incredible amount of time. What was the moment in that first year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years that you were like, fuck, I've got this. This is me. I'm on the journey.
Oh, I had it fucking day two. But, you know, that was in my mind. You know, there were so many different parts to it. You know, in treatment, I did 5.5 months in treatment in Bournemouth. And kind of like, you know, on the last day of treatment, I've said this very well documented, I say it all the time. They said to me, you can't go back to London. You can't go back to DJing. You can't go back to that relationship. And I was like, I'm not going back to anything. I'm going forward to it. And that's kind of the turning point in life for me, because it's always been about going forward. Although I talk about the past, I don't live in the past.
Yeah.
The past doesn't define me anymore. Today defines me. How I treat myself today, how I treat others around me, it defines who I am today. And it primarily starts here. And everything, if I'm having a bad morning and I treat myself bad, or, you know, then I will continue that. And I used to continue that for a year to 2 years. Now it will last for an hour or so like that, and then I can snap out of it. So there's been many, many moments throughout my recovery that I thought I'd cracked it. And what I'd done was I cracked level one.
Yeah.
It's like, again, and then I suddenly will go to the next level of recovery. You know, like the 12 steps, there's 12 different versions of Tony, and there's been 12 different versions of my recovery, and it's forever changing. And I really think that the minute you think that you've cracked it is the minute you become complacent and comfortable, and nothing ever good comes from being comfortable, ever.
Yeah.
Because what we do is we become sluggish, we take our foot off the gas, our learned behaviours creep back in. Because it's not, nothing now, I'm not ever in fear of ever using it again. And I can say that hand on heart. Mm. A lot of people go, oh my God, you can't say that. Today, I know I'm not going to use, right? And that's all that matters to me.
And that's all you can be in control of.
Exactly. And, you know, but for me, the bigger picture is the fact that why would I want to use or have a drink? My life's fucking incredible. Mm. My life is incredible. When you could get clean and they say, oh, you're going to get a life beyond your wildest dreams, and you just think, oh, fuck off. Do you know what I mean? I have got everything that I was promised and more. I have freedom. I have self-respect. I can love. I love who I am. Therefore, I can love someone else. And all of these, all of those last four things that I said are relatively new on the grand scale of things. You know, at the beginning, it's all about staying clean. It's all about, look at me. I went through the different phases of being the face of recovery, being the face of NA. I had no anonymity. And when you've got no anonymity, what comes is you invite the crazies in. And you've got to remember, those rooms are full of recovering addicts and alcoholics. There's a lot of fucking crazy. And I attracted to it. Like I was as a kid, I was attracted to the crazy. And what you find is when you get to certain further down the road with recovery is that you're attracted to the drama triangle. And I was on all sides of it and in the middle. And it's about standing back from that and thinking, okay, it's not about drama. Because, you know, the song I was going to have at my funeral was No More Drama, Mary J. Blige. I was going to have it tattooed on my arm when I got clean and all of these things, because it was always about drama, right? So drama become another level and another layer of addiction. Always drawn to drama. If there wasn't drama, I would create drama. You know, I could create drama watching Neighbours. You know, literally, like that's
what's Harold done today, though, wanker.
Oh, I would just start on everyone, you know,
Madge the slag,
totally.
Literally just fucking insane. And you know, so what comes as you get older and the more you go into recovery, you think, oh my god, life doesn't get better than this. Those are the crack it days. Those are the days where you think, and I have pinch me day. I have pinch me moments all the time where I have to literally think, how did the fuck did I get here? How brilliant! And that could be just walking the dog. That can be walking around Battersea Park. That can be at home in the moment with my partner and my dogs and just think, life doesn't get better than this.
It's the little things, right?
It really is. It's not about, you know, my career and what I do for a living. I have everything I have in my life today is from what I don't do, right? Don't get me wrong. I mean, of course, the career and all of that stuff, I wouldn't have any of it if I was still using. I'd be dead. But not even that. If I started drinking, I would lose it all. Because I don't do things in half measures, and I've never drank from a half-filled cup. Do you get what I mean? Yeah. It's either empty or and then it needs refilling.
Yeah.
Always, it's always been that continuous thing. And life's like that for me today. And I just think that, you know, what you put out in the world, you get back. And when I wrote my book, I've really thought I'd cracked it up to that point. You know, life was really good. Suddenly, you know, I went through lockdown and suddenly had this new found fame on Instagram and whatever because I didn't give a fuck. Mm. And I kind of was funny. And, you know, it was the next level of things happening. And I wrote this book because we did a film with Mixmag about addiction and it got watched by like 5 million people over lockdown. And I wanted everyone to understand that it wasn't just about addiction. It was a lot more to it and a lot more to what defines you and what why to understand it a little bit better. So I wrote that book and then, of course, once I handed the book in, that was it. It's like, I would need to get that book back. I literally woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning crying, thinking, what have you done? You've ruined your life. Because I've been so honest. Mm. And every bit of shame that I've had all my life, all the way through recovery. So like, you know, the first year of recovery, was, you know, yeah, the pink cloud, blah, blah, blah. I didn't really get sober, completely and utterly sober and addiction-free because it's not only about the alcohol and the drugs. For me, it was about the sex. So when I said to you earlier, at the age of 10, I was abused. That was my first primary illness was sex. Suddenly I could use sex to get what I wanted. And sex addiction overtook everything. Sex addiction was the one addiction I didn't mention in rehab. Sex addiction was the one addiction I didn't mention for 4 years of counselling. Sex addiction was the one I mentioned until I was 6 years sober and I lost my house and I lost everything at 6 years. I hit rock bottom in recovery because I never dealt with sex addiction. And like any addiction, it wants you dead, whether it be sex, food, gambling. Any of those addictions will kill you if you allow them to get to that point. Allows the wrong word because we're not in control. But, you know, if we turn a blind eye to any of those things, it will manifest into something so much far greater. Before you know it, you're back where you were. But I was back to square one in 6 years clean and sober, in recovery, as the face of recovery, suddenly homeless again, lost everything because my sex addiction took over.
Right.
And to have a partner that was also in recovery, telling everyone in recovery what you've done as the face of recovery, you know, it's like, where do you... Yeah. So what I did was I got on my knees and asked for help. I removed the ego, because ego comes from fear, as we know, right? Mm. I removed that ego and I just asked for help. And life changed really dramatically again. So that was another part of recovery where I thought, oh, I've cracked it again.
Yeah.
And it goes on. You know, it's every day is a new lesson, I find.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, it just goes to show that addiction just doesn't discriminate, does it? It exists in, you know, so many different forms and they all have to be dealt with.
You know, you don't, as I say, you don't need to be on a park bench to be an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And you certainly don't need to be pulling your teeth out to be an addict. Mm. But, you know, because it happens in so many different levels. You know, I've got friends that are completely like major addicts when it comes to work. You know, within business. You know, I have friends that gamble. I have friends that justify, you know, their behaviours, you know, around women or around men. or on apps. All of these things, it manifests in so many ways. And what we do is we get blinkered, we go into flow with anything. You know, I could have sushi, I've said this so many times, on a Monday and it's really fucking good. I'll have it Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday until I can't fucking hold my own shit in because I've eaten so much raw fish.
Yeah.
And I get so ill. That, you know, graphic is me, right?
I love it.
But that's where it goes. And that's when you think, fuck, what are you doing, dude?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
That's so bizarre. I'm the exact same. If I have a good meal, that's like my meal for the week.
Mm.
Yeah.
So true.
It's like you were saying before about trainers. You've got a trainer addiction. It's a healthy addiction. Some could say no addiction is healthy, but you know what they are? That's not true. You know, anything that's moderated or that you can moderate, you're not injecting trainers into your arm, are you?
No, this
is
true.
Not snorting. Not yet. You know, the thing about it is I can go and buy a pair of shoes. I love them and I have to get them in three different colors. The same shoe, they go under the bed, they go into the cupboard, they go into wardrobe, they go into piles, they go and end up in storage.
And the Dean's laughing there.
Because that's how it goes. I that's how it goes for me. And, you know, I know that I can make a phone call and get those for nothing, but I don't want to do that. Mm. I've earned them. Yeah. So I go and buy them.
No, I'm with you.
And you know what? I used to buy people in my life things out of guilt because I was such a... I know the relationship's not working. Let me get a dog. You know,
this is the 15th dog you've bought.
Let's get a baby, or I turn up with a present. You know, because it was guilt, and you know, it's really hard when you're in recovery to actually get to that beyond that point of thinking, okay, I deserve to buy myself a pair of trainers. I've worked really hard. Why wouldn't I get a pair of trainers? What else am I going to spend that on?
Yeah, of course.
You're not spending the rent money.
No.
On it, do you know what I mean? You're not spending like food money. A part of recovery is getting yourself to a position, right, where you can afford to do those things, and you can afford to do it not only financially but mentally.
Yeah,
that's a really big thing. Do you know what I mean? To say, okay, yeah, so what if I buy a pair of shoes or two or three?
Yeah,
do you know what I'm saying to you?
Yeah,
but as long as you know it's you not sold the roof over your own head to pay for those trainings. Because, you know, if you work hard,
I'm with you.
I used to be so guilty of being like, oh, I really need a new pair of jeans. Oh, I can't afford that, 70 quid. And then that weekend going out and buying five bags, spending 250 quid. And you'd be justifying that money being like, hang on, I've got holes in these fucking jeans. It's so dumb how we program ourselves.
I'm with you. When I lost my house in 96, the house of that, my dream house. When I lost that and I moved into my friend's house, gave me a flat. He was like, I'm selling this flat, you can live in there until I sell it. In fact, I'm going to keep it for another 3 years. You can live there rent free in Brick Lane. You know, like massive flat in Brick Lane, blah, blah, blah. I didn't even have a telly because I'd sold the telly. I left the last house with just the mirror that I used to get two drugs on. That was all I moved with because I thought I can get it all again. That's been my life. Yeah. I'll get it again. I don't care about that stuff. You know what I mean? If you want it, take it. I'll move on. And I had this house. And my friend said, oh, we're throwing our telly out. It's not working. I was like, I'll have it. I had this telly, right? At this point in time, I was still traveling up the motorway. I was earning a fortune. I had a telly with half a screen. And I would sit and watch half a screen like this.
Watching Gladiators.
Literally,
that one always wins.
Half the screen. It was just this side. Like, literally, that was it. Because I didn't want to spend that money, because that money was drug money, on buying a new TV. Why would I want to buy a new TV when I could buy an 8 for Coke? Don't be stupid.
I've got half TV here.
I'm all right with half a TV.
So you want to buy the other half?
Literally, I'm all right with half a TV. That's the levels of insanity. Do you go and say to you, it literally would be like, why have you got half a TV? Yeah, like, right. Don't ask. Do you go what I mean? It was like insane.
100%.
I think it's time.
Time for the big three.
Yeah. We normally end each episode with three questions.
Go.
I'll take the first two. So for anyone...
Addict.
I'll take the first two.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was either dregs for me.
You have the biggest one.
I do have the big one. It's fine.
But yeah, so for anyone thinking of going on like a journey of sobriety, what's your single best piece of advice?
Make sure you want to do it. Don't listen to anyone else telling you that you've got a problem. If all your friends are telling you you've got a problem, you've got a fucking problem, right? But the thing is, don't make it their problem. All right, it's your problem. And I think the thing is, you won't change until you get to that point where you really, really need to change, where you can't do it anymore. And only you know that. You know, when people go, oh, we're doing an intervention, it's like, fuck off. All you're going to do is make him go underground. You're going to push it, make it worse. You know, don't get me wrong, interventions do work occasionally, very occasionally. But 9 times out of 10, that no one can change unless they want to change. So just get to that point where you think, I can't do this, which is normally on a Sunday night or you've been out all weekend. If you do get to those magical moments of, I can't do this, right? And you've got your phone in your fucking hand, suddenly go on there and reach out. And the next day, if you regret it, that's absolutely fine. But you know what? You've started the ball rolling.
Put it into the universe.
Literally. That's it.
Yeah.
The biggest thing that you'll ever do in your life is to say those words, I need help.
Yeah.
It's the biggest thing. Because you don't open your mouth, you don't get fed.
Love that.
Yeah, that's great. That's great advice. Question two, what is the biggest benefit, the single biggest benefit the sobriety has brought you?
I have a life. The biggest thing, I'm getting married next year.
Congrats. Yeah.
Fucking sick. Getting married. At 58, I'm getting married.
I love that.
Recovery is just, it's, you know, without being preachy, it's the single best thing and decision you'll ever make in your life because it gives you a life. It's as simple as that.
Beautiful.
That is perfect.
Question three.
Question three. We would like Tony now to write drunk Tony a letter and start with Dear Tony. What would you say to fat Tony?
What would I say to drunk Tony?
So sober Tony.
To sober drunk Tony, to drunk Tony. Yeah. Shut the fuck up and listen, you stupid cunt. It's as simple as that. Because you know what? I've never listened. And I, even when I got into recovery, I didn't listen. Even for the first 6 years, 7 years, I didn't listen. I didn't listen to my gut. I now listen to my gut. My gut's a really good indication of when I shouldn't be doing something. I get a gut feeling, what are you doing? And that serves me, and I need to listen to that more. And listening is just listening to other people, other experiences, identifying, and literally taking it on board. Mm. You know, there's so much I have been told and shown that I've never, ever looked at or even listened to, because I always thought I knew best.
Yeah.
And we don't know, we know jack fucking shit when it comes to it on the grand scale of things. So yeah, literally, when you start going to 12-step meetings, you get these like arseholes who preach in the rooms, you know, I'll sit on your hands, put cotton wool in your mouth and not in your ears. And all of these sayings that they say them for a fucking reason. You know, I used to think, oh, shut up, you arsehole. But you know what, it was like, there again, didn't listen.
Yeah.
You know, and I wasted so much time by not listening.
Amazing. Mate, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much
really
for coming.
Appreciate your time.
Really enjoyed it.
All the way to Hackney.
I was going to say Hackney. Thank you for making the schlep.
The absolute pilgrimage.
If we have the pleasure of meeting again, we'll come to Pimlico.
Yeah, you do that.
You're like, you fucking do that.
You'd be like that whole saying, hi, I'm in your area. Yeah, we'll enjoy it. Hi, I'm in town. Yeah, have a nice time.
thank you so much.
You're welcome,
thank
guys.
You.
Cheers.
Big love.
DJ Fat Tony.
Mate, that was an absolute whirlwind of a conversation. I loved every second of it. I think what I thought that chat could be and what it was, like, just even surpassed how great I thought it would be.
Yeah, crazy story. And, you know, someone that really, I guess, in terms of like addiction on every aspect from drink, drugs, sex, you know, like, yeah, there's a whole spectrum of stuff we talked about. But before we get into the crux of it, I just want to point out that it's Sunday evening for me. It's 20 past seven and it's currently 6 a.m. and you're in Australia in your hotel room.
Yeah, it is, man. I'm having honestly the best time. Like, I love this place so much. I feel really grounded and earthed here. But for some reason, this time around, like, I landed at midnight, I was in bed in Byron by like 2 a.m. and my first two nights sleep were like perfect. I had no jet lag, I felt really good.
And then since then, like the last 4 days, honestly, have been brutal. Like I'm going to sleep at like maybe midnight and then waking up at 2, 3, 4, 5 and just being like, fuck it, I'll get up. And then I've had two club shows that then finished at like 3 a.m. So then I'm going to bed at 3 a.m. And then at like 6 a.m. it's like, morning. I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? But it's fine. I think with any of these things, like sobriety makes me really grateful because like, yeah, I'm genuinely probably some of the most tired I've ever been, but I don't care. I'm getting up, I'm walking. I think yesterday I walked 35,000 steps on my own into these little bits of Sydney I'd never explored. I'm talking to every fucking bar staff about zeros. Like it's, they must think I'm such a twat. I went to this place called the Red Fern yesterday in this little suburb called Red Fern. I was like, oh, what have you got? And she was like, you know, heaps normal. And then this one called Outcless, which I put out on the pod, which was like incredible. It's a little behind the UK, I must say, and I think a lot of our listeners have flagged that when it comes to zeros and like alcohol alternatives. But yeah, people were like super interested in like the subject and the topic matter. And she did say the bar staff was like, oh, more and more people are asking. So like we're gonna start stocking a lot more. So yeah, man, I'm in the big upside down. But I've still got like, I'm still not back for 10 days. It feels like a lifetime.
Wow. Yeah, it does. It's very weird. Like, because we're doing our gratitude list like upside down at the moment. You're doing it like in the evening and waking up and doing it to me, and then like in my morning I'm doing it to you. So it's like,
I know, that was funny actually, because I got confused. I think I'm actually one ahead of you, because I was just like, I think I did one in the morning and the evening because it was like a different day for you. I was like, I'm grateful for everything.
Oh mate, well, no, I'm glad you're having a good time. And it's a weird one actually with sobriety and jet lag, because I feel like jet lag's way worse now I'm sober, but I'm obviously way more grateful for being sober because I'm able to go and enjoy stuff and you can survive being tired. But the more routine I think you are in your body, I think the worse it is, because you'll suddenly just, your body's just like, what's going on? What's happening? But I heard a really, Diplo, I think I might have mentioned this before, DJ Diplo, he was saying that because he's like in different time zones, pretty much like 4 different time zones a week, the guy's like everywhere. He just said running for him is like a staple thing. Like as soon as he gets off a flight, the first thing he'll do is go and run for like an hour, hour and a half. And just says, hey, I don't know if it's all jet lag or anything, but in terms of like movement and blood flow, yeah, and everything else, it's going to be a really good thing. So I haven't actually done that much traveling in the last like few months, which has been nice. But I know later this year will be, I'm going to try it. But no, I'm glad. I'm envious, mate. I'm seeing all the beach pictures and everything. I'm like, fuck, it's still miserable.
Yeah, it's nice.
Here. Yeah, going back to the episode, I like, it blew my mind how someone was just functioning and still alive, actually, if I'm completely honest. When he was saying about the depth of addiction and like where he was at certain like times of his career and life, like it really got me when he was saying he was DJing, was it Egg or somewhere else, and he had like 1 tooth left and had like barred his boyfriend at the time from being there. And was barred from the club because he would try and like rescue him. I was like, oh, that's so dark.
Yeah, and I think the episode goes a real long way to show that rock bottom doesn't mean that you're always going to see a way out of a rock bottom. It felt like he had continuous rock bottoms. And then, you know, I guess speaking so openly and candidly about his childhood and the things that he saw and the abuse, I mean, you can see why, and we've had it with so many of our guests where there's melting pots, right? And it's like all these things go into this ingredient, all the ingredients go in, sorry, and it pulls a human being out that, you know, falls into addiction. But I think the thing I found really interesting as well was that thing where he said he felt like he hit rock bottom 6 years after going sober from alcohol and drugs and realizing that sex was an issue. Because I caught up with a friend here actually yesterday, and he was talking about like masturbation addiction and things like that, and porn addiction, and there's a big issue over here with like pokey addiction. And it made me think actually, and Tony was probably one of the first guests that really opened up about like addiction takes no prisoners and can come in so many different ways. And even when you think you're sober from the things that are hurting you, like a sex addiction is essentially hurting you and everyone around you, or the people that you love, or the person you're in a relationship with as well. So I thought that was a really interesting angle that, you know, isn't one for you and I to dissect right now, but definitely I think even an episode where we could dive into, you know, addictions that are linear alongside drug and alcohol and substance abuse, because there are so many.
100%. And, you know, it's almost like what's harmful for you, because I think even in like day-to-day life, we talk about stuff like coffee. I think a lot of people I mean, I'm probably in a cycle of addiction with coffee. I take it away. I'm the worst. I'm headaches. I'm grumpy. I'm like, oh, fuck. Like, sugar, we know that in all kind of content that we eat and through the sort of westernized diet, everything's full of sugar. And again, like coming off that and eating really clean, which I know we've both done at times over the last couple of years, is the most brutal thing. But yeah, I mean, I think it's probably, I think you're right. We should explore, have a proper addiction episode on everything that could be harmful to us and people around us.
Because we do get, you're so right. We do get into these addictive cycles. Since my sobriety, coffee is the thing for me. Like being out here, I'm like, oh, you know, I'm really looking forward to this morning going and finding like the best coffee spot. And then I'll have a couple. And I don't ever get it to the point where I'm like, maybe I do by accident sometimes. You're like laying in bed with your heart fucking racing because you're like caffeine to fuck. But no, I think to go back to Tony, like, yeah, just an incredible human being. And I think his disdain and hatred for Hackney was nothing I've ever seen before. And I loved it in every facet. I literally walked in and was like, why the fuck am I here? I was like,
yeah,
I love
he's
you.
He's not happy about Hackney, but yeah, I love it.
What was the thing for you that stood out the most?
I thought it was quite interesting, really, how he, I think, didn't want money and how he just tried to get rid of it. And it's crazy, isn't it? Because like, this is something that a lot of people strive for, is like financial security. And he was making more than like most of us could ever dream of making. And because of obviously the sort of childhood trauma he'd gone through, didn't like it and just get rid of it. Whether that was like drugs, drink, partying, like whatever it was, he was like, I just want it gone. And it made me really sad because like, you know, for most people, I think financial security is something that like we all strive for, right? Like whether it's like you or your family or future, you kind of, you know, for me, it's something that I strive for, like financial freedom. It's like a thing we talk about quite a lot. Like if anything, God forbid, was to happen to me, the house is taken care of, like everyone's sort of going to be all right financially. It's a kind of a big thing. And it just made me think like, shit, this guy like hated money and just wanted to get rid of it. And just because of, I guess, the really unfortunate circumstances that happened when he was in his childhood, and yeah, it made me really sad. But you know, the fact that he was sitting here with us telling his story and had been sober for, what was it, 17 years now?
Yeah, and that's remarkable. It right, like I think, you know, we have people on from all walks of addiction, from all walks of sobriety. Anna, 100 days, you know, re-establishing her relationship, and that's something that actually I think has resonated bigger and wider than I thought it could with Anna, because I think so many people, I mean, our followers have gone up by like 10%, I think, or 20%, like since that episode. Cause I think there's so many people being like, oh fuck, that's me. Like maybe I didn't think I had an issue, but maybe I should readdress it, all the way through to like Tony, who probably out of anyone I've ever even met in life is like so far in the realms of, you know, pulling your own teeth out, like complete, I guess, like mental detachment from reality and not seeing that there was an issue. I mean, that was the thing that I think really stood out to me, was like there were clearly points where any human being would look at this person and think, fucking hell, you need help. And that person couldn't see it in themselves, which is quite a scary place to be. Like I know if I look in the mirror in sobriety, or even pre-sobriety, and I've like put on a bit of weight, or like I don't feel like I look well, or, you know, this morning I'm look fucking tired. I'm so hyper aware of those things. And obviously like you shouldn't be too aware and you don't want to be superficial with it. But I then like, you know, I went out for a massive meal last night. I feel quite bleh this morning. So I'm probably going to just have a smoothie for breakfast and not eat until this afternoon, right? Because I'll be like, that's how I'm going to readdress how I feel about myself. For someone to be in that depth of addiction that like you cannot see what's in front of you, you cannot see yourself in the mirror, you cannot see what you have become and how you are hurting people around you. Like, I think to come out the other side of that and to be arguably more successful than you were in the fame period that got you there, it's a real success story. And I can see why people in the space really gravitate towards him, because he takes no fucking prisoners. He'll say it exactly how it is. I don't think he glamorizes it. And that was the other thing I really wanted to pick up on this outro, actually, was like, I feel, and I know you mentioned this, but I had maybe not a preconception, but, you know, when you've got someone who knows Kate Moss and Elton John and Boy George and all these people, and like he said, all the taglines in the book were like, Freddie Mercury gave me my first line of coke. He's like, but I've never said those things as I'm proud of them. I've said them because they were factual and people have picked up on them. What I felt with Tony was just, you just met this really fucking
sincere but funny human being who's just been on a journey. And I didn't feel there was any of that glamorization of it. It was just factual, like it fucking happened.
Completely. And yeah, he doesn't glamorize it. It's quite the opposite, isn't it? So, you know, and he clarified that. And I think it was evident from starting to chat to him that that was the case. So, but yeah, mate, I really enjoyed this episode. I've enjoyed this season so far. It's been incredible. You know, we've had some amazing guests and, you know, we're still at the start of the season. So
I know.
It's pretty nuts.
It's odd because I feel like we did so much prep for it and then everything's just like crept up on us now that we're rolling and they're coming out. Because obviously I'm going to miss you and young David. When are you catching up next week?
Week after. Yeah.
Week after. Nice. And then we've got a very, very special episode, hopefully, if I can get it cleared by their team, coming mid-April, I think, which should also line up with us announcing our final special guest for the London show, 1st of May, Leicester Square Theatre. Mate, I can be on the other side of the world and I'm still going to get it in.
Still plugging it. I think your mission is to, while you're out there, see if we can get any Australians to fly for the show. That'd be the big one, wouldn't it?
Oh, mate, I will. I might do it today with like a placard. To be fair, there's quite a lot of like Jesus placards on the street and people yelling. So maybe I'll just like print off a big sobriety one. I must say, ticket-wise, I think so many seem to have gone over the weekend. Like, I've noticed all the little green dots vanishing. So if you are thinking of coming to our live show, this isn't even like a stupid plug. I just want to make sure that people get tickets because we've probably like tripled our weekly sales week on week, haven't we? So if you are thinking of getting them this payday, because I'm aware that money's tight for people, but like, yeah, don't sleep on it because it's probably the last payday where there'll be a big rush of tickets.
Nice, that was a good plug, but a very true and genuine plug. So.
No, it wasn't. That's the thing. I wasn't here being like, you know, just tickets now.
I'm excited for it. So, but we did it. We did an outro from the other side of the world.
Mate, really good to see you, bro. I miss you lots. And I will, I'm back April 3rd and then you go away April 5th. So I'm coming to your house April 4th. On no sleep to do an episode.
We are.
Things we do for you guys. Awesome. All right, man. Lots of love. Love to the family, and I'll catch up with you soon.
Have a good day. Nice one.
Peace.